Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, countering the men's rights movement by acknowledging that men are misunderstood.
And was Jane Austen really a reclusive spinster? A new book argues not even close.
But first, the Tempe City Council made an about-face on a controversial policy earlier this month after facing intense backlash and the threat of a citizens' referendum. The issue at hand, a parks ordinance that city leaders say was about updating an outdated policy and keeping parks safe for everyone, and activists say was aimed at preventing aid groups from feeding the homeless in them.
The ordinance would have required a gathering of more than 30 people to get a permit to meet in a city park. And it was met with protests and a lawsuit from advocates from the start. They claimed the law would have infringed on their First Amendment rights, allowing city officials to approve or deny events.
Now, this all has a complicated history in Tempe. The city has gone back and forth with homeless rights activist Austin Davis, first celebrating his picnics for homeless people in Tempe parks and then telling him he needed a permit to carry them out, which was denied.
The conflict ended in Davis's arrest and the city banning him from parks until 2026. And so, when the city council unanimously passed this ordinance earlier this year, advocates were quick to cry foul. They saw it as another example of potential city overreach.
As for Mayor Corey Woods, he cites that lawsuit as the reason city officials couldn't go through a lengthier public process to approve the measure. I sat down with him in our studios recently to talk more about the decision and why he voted to repeal it now.
Our last park ordinance was actually updated back in 1967. We are obviously a very different city at this point. We have nearly 200,000 residents. We have the largest public university in the country in ASU right in our backyard. And we obviously have much more in the way of additional parks than we had back in 1967. So it's sort of a regular thing as a city council to look at your ordinances and regulations and trying to make sure that you're really keeping up with present day times. Back in September of 2024, our city attorney's office, along with some folks from our park staff, began to talk about what they thought could be some updates to the ordinance to kind of bring it into present day.
Okay, so the updates here to this special events ordinance were really controversial right from the start. I know you heard from a lot of angry residents about this. There were protests after it was passed initially. They gathered signatures to put it back on the ballot for a referendum. And generally, you know, people were outraged because they said this is not just an update to the parks ordinance. This is about homelessness and events to feed the homeless in the parks. And that city leaders were, you know, not upfront about their real motives. What was your response to that?
We felt that it wasn't. I mean, if you look at the actual ordinance, the way that it was written, it was completely content neutral. There were no references in the ordinance to homelessness or unhoused or unsheltered or anything that would have come off as we're trying to target a certain population. I was telling people, hey, if you want to have a child's birthday party, have a sweet 16, have a family reunion, or even if you want to host a mutual aid event to give people water or socks or underwear, you know, all we're looking for is sort of a parks permit, a limited parks permit that would cost anywhere from $8 to $25. We just sort of thought this seems like a really good update to a very old policy and once again written in a very content neutral way as not to target any specific group whatsoever.
But it still would have applied to those kinds of picnics, the events for homeless folks in the parks, right?
Oh, sure. It would have applied to people hosting an event if there were 30 or more people, but the same thing would have happened for a birthday party. Despite all of that, there was obviously a lot of concern that ensued about the ordinance. And I can talk about that a little bit because the issue was that we went through the public hearing process as mm-hmm. we are mandated to do. We had public hearings back on June 5th and on July 1st. And so we have a two public hearing process and we completely abided by that. Our residents are frankly very used to having a much longer runway when it comes to sort of public involvement and their ability to give input back to the council and back to staff. Mm-hmm. The challenge was we actually had a lawsuit that was filed against us in court. And that's sort of what necessitated the expediting of it. It was determined that we needed to go faster to really ensure that we got a passed ordinance back in front of the judge as soon as possible. However, now, given the point that that lawsuit has since been dropped and we don't have sort of any litigation, you know, hanging over our heads, that was one of the reasons why personally I was very much in favor of rescinding the ordinance and going back to the drawing board and having a much more involved, robust community input process.
So you're saying this was not in response to the conversation and kind of the long ongoing debate about city parks being used for events to feed homeless folks in Tempe. But there is a history here. I mean, we've seen this long kind of back and forth between the city of Tempe and homeless rights activist Austin Davis, who used to host picnics in Tempe parks. You know, the city started requiring to have a permit. Those permits were denied. There ended up being a lawsuit, an arrest made, a plea deal. Like, this goes on and on. But you're saying this was not in response to that?
To me, it wasn't. I mean, I can't speak for other people on council, but when I was making the decision to vote for the ordinance during the first go around and then to rescind it, that was not what was going through my head.
Advocates were also upset about infringement on First Amendment rights here. I mean, did that factor into your decision to repeal this? I mean, did you think having that ordinance on the books could discourage things like protests and gatherings?
When I read the ordinance, and I read it probably two or three times prior to voting for it, I didn't think in any way, shape, or form it would have had a chilling effect on First Amendment protests and demonstrations. If I had had that concern back on July 1st, I would not have voted for it. At the same time, though, once again, we do have to be responsive to the needs of residents and the concerns that they raise. I'm looking forward to that public process. I think that the input from residents in this community could only make the policy better.
So I've been asking you a lot about what advocates for the homeless have been saying here, and they've been very loud voices in this process. But there have also been concerns cited from residents in Tempe about the presence of people experiencing homelessness in the parks and, you know, whether it be drugs or, you know, paraphernalia, problems with that. You have to take that into consideration as well, I'm guessing.
Sure. I mean, that is definitely a consideration when you're in a role like mine. And I've definitely heard from both sides. I absolutely have heard from folks who do mutual aid work. And I also have heard from residents who have had very big concerns about large gatherings in the park and some of the things that they've seen over the last few years.
Okay, so you just outlined a lot of the different views you've been hearing on this debate from various residents, from various groups in Tempe. What do you think? Like, how do you view the city's role in addressing homelessness?
I think that the role of the city is, frankly, to provide lots of support to people who are unhoused and in need of services. You know, since 2022, we've invested more than $137 million in trying to really up the services that we offer. We spent $20 million acquiring the Apache Inn on Apache Boulevard, which is going to open later this fall, and it's going to be a 60-room shelter for people who are in need. And those rooms will be configured to hold anywhere from one to four people. So my perspective is we have a moral and ethical responsibility to support people in our community who are in need. We should never turn our backs on them. At the same time, we can also make sure that people feel that their neighborhoods are comfortable, safe places, and their schools are as well. And my hope is that we will end up coming up with a policy at the end of the day that can be accepted by the majority of people in our community as one that they feel like they had real input and insight on. And this process may not take weeks, it may take months, because the concern that myself and the city council have and our staff has is not about speed and trying to get something done in a rapid fashion. It's about trying to get something that actually works and works on behalf of the people in our community. And the people of our community, I mean everyone, housed or unhoused.
All right. Tempe Mayor Corey Woods joining us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Conversations about what to do with a generation of disaffected, hyper-online young men are rampant these days. A wide range of digital content creators, in particular YouTubers and podcasters, have created a movement of aggrieved men who feel fierce resentment about the focus on women and feminist causes in recent years. And so, a growing community of scholars are trying to build a philosophical framework to push back against the influence of this so-called men's rights movement. One of the most prominent thinkers in that pushback is Richard Reeves, a former senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Reeves rejects the premise of the men's rights argument, that there's some sort of vast conspiracy against men, but says there should be more acknowledgement of the ways that young men's struggles aren't being looked at as closely as they could be. Eamon Whalen profiled Reeves and his ideas for The Nation earlier this year. I spoke with him about Reeves and the ways he thinks the country could be doing a better job of meeting the moment.
You know, one like the CDC not acknowledging male suicide disparities. That's something that Reeves brings up often. It can seem trivial stuff, but I think to a lot of aggrieved men build up over time, it can seem like there is some kind of something that is not being acknowledged. And so Reeves is saying, I want to start this American Institute of Boys and Men and write about this, and as a social scientist, have the best, most up-to-date data. And I need to be what he calls a quote-unquote boring institution advocating for men, so that when an Andrew Tate or a Jordan Peterson or one of these figures says that men are a persecuted class and the mainstream is being silent about it, that Reeves can say, hey, we're not being silent about it. I am actually recognizing the ways which men are struggling, and I am actually, giving you the best data. His trying to be a bulwark against this sort of backlash was a compelling part of his work.
What is your sense of how Reeves resonates with men? Because hearing you talk about it and reading your piece, he comes across as a much more reasoned, institutionally minded, practical, measured sort of voice on a subject. And I think you could argue that one of the reasons that voices like Tate's or Jordan Peterson's are very compelling for men is that they're making much more of an emotional appeal. Do you get the sense that men online are interested in the approach that somebody like Reeves takes?
I think that's a really great point. And I think the best way to answer that is that Reeves is, writing for men in some ways, but as I open my piece, that Reeves' target audience is the parents of a boy who uh-huh. might be drawn into this sort of culture to sort of give them a little bit more context for why they might be pulled into this. And I've asked Reeves, I asked him if he had ever thought about going down the more guru prescriptive kind of self-help, because that is a lot of ways to think about these figures, is that it is a form of kind of distinctly masculine self-help. I don't think Reeves is trying to appeal exactly to that audience. I think he's sort of trying to build consensus. What I see him currently doing is building consensus amongst the sort of an intellectual and political elite in the U.S. to sort of acknowledge that this is a problem. And it's a hot button issue. He's doing his best not to try to offend anyone.
But it also seems like another challenge here is the perceived imperative to address whether or not there is something essentially biologically true about men that makes them feel aggrieved or makes them want certain things, want to be at the top of the hierarchy. How much does the perceived need to address the quote-unquote essential biology of men figure into all this?
That is a great and very thorny question, and that is partly where Reeves runs into some of his kind of criticism amongst the left and amongst feminists of placing too much of an emphasis on biology. And someone that I interviewed for my story, Niobe Way, who's a developmental psychologist at NYU and has written several books about young men's socialization, criticized Reeves, with qualified criticism. Everyone in my story is a critic, is pretty measured in their criticism, but essentially he doesn't place enough emphasis on the socialization of boys as they become men, that a lot of this socialization then, you have to dominate, you have to be stoic, you can't show your emotions, that is a social construction, and also that it is the type of masculinity that we are socialized to perform actually ends up being very unhealthy and unhelpful for men as they go through their life. It damages their relationships, their self-image. They feel like they can't perform to this ideal.
Do you think there needs to be somebody who
has a similar energy to a Tate or a Peterson, but is approaching this from the opposite perspective.
Yeah, I think Reeves, I think his work kind of provides an opening for people and a sort of a conversation starter for people. I do think you need to have meet men culturally on the internet in a certain way. When I talk to young men in my story for Mother Jones that were on, I found them on this Reddit forum called X Red Pill. So they had been Red Pill and then they had gotten out. They had kind of been indoctrinated into this worldview that their problems were all to blame on women. And like I said, they had this very, very, very rigid kind of evolutionary view of gender roles and behavior. That ended up just not being very good for them. That just, mm-hmm. they thought, like, I remember one of the kids I interviewed, it broke my heart. He said that he didn't want to be in a relationship anymore because if basically he was taught to think women were so low intelligence and so sort of dictated by not like animalistic instincts, but he basically said that I thought so low of women that I didn't even think being in a relationship was worth anything. Like he was almost then like moving away, not like moving away from heterosexuality, but he didn't even want to pursue women anymore because he had grown such resentment towards them. And he was sort of like, what is the point of this anymore? Wow. I thought I was going online to become a man. He had literally typed into YouTube male advice and that had taken him on his journey where he ended up a Tate fan. So I do think a lot of this would be better if it would happen offline, you know, actual like logging off and touching grass, as they say. It's not that simple, but that's, I think, a good way to sort of start at it.
Well, Eamon Whalen is a reporter who has covered masculinity and the so-called manosphere for outlets including Mother Jones and The Nation. Eamon, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, contrary to what you might think, Jane Austen was friends with abolitionists, suffragists, and an international spy. We'll hear from the author of a new book that examines Austen's wild inner life and legacy.
But first this morning, let's turn to Tucson and ongoing tensions between the Pima County Attorney's Office and the Tucson Police Department that recent events have brought out into the open. It started with the case of Daniel Hollander, who went into a Tucson school in January, armed and apparently in the midst of a psychotic episode. He was disarmed and arrested by a police officer working at the school, which was all cheered as a win for the rule of law. But then things went awry, at least in the eyes of the Tucson police officers who arrested him. Hollander was indicted by a grand jury of three serious felonies and a misdemeanor, but he got a plea deal from the county attorney's office. Tucson PD says the sentence wasn't enough for someone who put himself in the position to commit a mass shooting in a Tucson school. But Pima County Attorney Laura Conover argues it was the police officer who had mishandled the case, not reading the suspect his Miranda rights and necessitating the eventual plea deal. Well, there's a lot of outrage about Hollander's case in Tucson, but our next guest says he's more concerned about what he sees as a pattern of light treatment of repeat offenders. Tim Steller is a longtime columnist for the Arizona Daily Star, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning there, Tim.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for coming on. So I outlined the case of Daniel Hollander there, which is kind of bringing a lot of these tensions to light. But you say you have concerns about repeat offenders, particularly those who are charged with illegally possessing guns. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, this started to come to light a year or two ago when Tucson police started going to the federal prosecutors to pursue prohibited possessor cases against people that they thought had endangered the public through gunfire and illegally possessed firearms because they were felons who had guns. A lot of these were gang members or other people who ended up shooting people or shooting at least in the air out in public. And what they had noticed, Tucson police, is that in the Pima County Attorney's Office, a lot of cases were being pled down to from prohibited possessor to solicitation of prohibited possession or attempt to possess a firearm illegally. these are probation eligible charges. And so theoretically, they don't take people off the street. Mm-hmm. Whereas taking these cases to the federal prosecutors was more easily getting prison sentences for them.
Right. So they're kind of going around the county attorney's office now. What has the county attorney, Laura Conover, had to say about all this?
Well, on the prohibited possessor situation, she kind of defended herself earlier this year and noted that there were her office last year had prosecuted 572 prohibited possessor cases, while the feds had only prosecuted 60 local prohibited possessor cases. Mm-hmm. But I was able to get a hold. They provided me with a spreadsheet of those 572 cases, and I was really surprised to find that 44% had been dismissed. Hmm. So it really was, we were talking about 320, I think was the number, cases that she had prosecuted. And then another 17% were pled down to probation eligible charges. So it's clearly this was a previously existing tension that existed between the Tucson police and the Pima County Attorney's Office, but it was kind of, that tension was kind of kept hidden until the Daniel Hollander case came out.
Yeah. So you call it a revolving door, basically, that if this is what the police are accusing of happening, right? They see these people all the time. If prosecutors allow folks to get these lower plea deals, they're still on the street or they're back on the street. Describe what that looks like, some of the cases that you outlined.
Well, there was one man whose case I pulled out. I went through 20 of the cases that had been pled down, and one of the men had moved to Tucson in March 2020. He was promptly arrested for being a felon in possession of a firearm. He had a traffic stop and had meth and a gun, or a couple of guns. So they pushed him through the system, and according to the pre-sentence report, he had two previous felon in possession cases. I'm sorry, they were pled down to mm-hmm. solicitation to possess a firearm. So in both cases, he was given probation. And then in this third case here in Pima County, he was again given solicitation to possess a firearm and got probation. And within a year, he had already done the same crime again mm-hmm. and was stopped in June this year with a gun and meth. And so this person, I don't know if he has done any violence. I don't, not that I know of, but there are other cases. For example, the case of a man who attacked a police officer who was trying to stop him for shoplifting outside of Circle K. That man was a previous violent offender and had been just kind of let go repeatedly.
Let me ask you, Tim, lastly here in the last minute or so about the politics here. Conover is a Democrat. Tucson's a blue city, right? Is there a political undertone, you think, to these accusations by the police against her office?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think this is a longstanding tension often between police officers and police departments and prosecutors, because prosecutors are dealing with legal restraints that police often don't either see or don't believe are necessary. So like in this Hollander case, the police wanted her to take the case to the judge and see if the evidence would be thrown out rather than just deciding it would be on her own. Mm-hmm. So politically, I mean, typically police are more conservative politically than the general audience and general public. And so that's the case here. And so it's kind of not an unexpected tension, but it's a little harsher than it has been. And it finally came out in the public.
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there for now. Tim Steller, columnist for the Arizona Daily Star in Tucson, joining us. Tim, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
There have been more than 2 million new cancer diagnoses in the U.S. so far this year, according to the National Cancer Institute. And for a number of those patients, that cancer will either spread or stop responding to treatment. But new research being done by scientists at ASU, Mayo Clinic, MIT, Stanford, and other institutions is hoping to prevent that from happening and to stay a step ahead of those tumors. Ken Buto is a professor at ASU with the Center for Evolution and Medicine in the School of Complex Adaptive Systems. He's also with the School of Life Sciences. He says the research is starting with a focus on three metastatic cancers, breast, colon, and lung, but is open to exploring all cancers. He spoke with our co-host Mark Brody more about this work, and they started with how novel the approach is that he's trying to take to help cancer patients. Is this a new approach or more of a new technology?
It's actually a new approach enabled by new technology. The technology is somewhat incremental from what we've had in the past. We've over the last two decades, we've had the ability to increasingly do finer resolution characterization at the molecular level of cancer. But what is new, there's something genuinely new here, and that's that what we're taking into account is not just what does the tumor look like today, but actually its capacity to evolve and adapt to the treatments that we are that we're going to be administering.
So are you trying to deal with the issue of the tumor changing based on the treatment that the patient is getting? Like if a patient is getting chemotherapy or radiation or something, that might cause the tumor to change, which might make it less – the treatment less effective?
Absolutely. And one of the things that we've come to – understand as we've done more and more genomic characterization of tumors is that tumors are really complex and complicated. They are not static entities. They actually change dramatically over time and in response to the environment. Part of that environment, as you might guess, would be when we treat cancer.
Mm-hmm.
As you're more than aware, we've made great strides in novel targeted therapeutics directed at cancer. But nevertheless, still all too commonly, cancer comes back. And oftentimes it comes back, you know, very, very aggressively. What we're attempting to do in this new program is to try to anticipate how cancer responds to those therapies and then direct our next iteration of therapy at how it evaded the particular therapy it received.
Would this have more utility during maybe that first round of treatment, or is it more targeted at, as you reference, when a tumor in many cases unfortunately inevitably comes back after having been shrunk or entirely gotten rid of the first time?
Well, we're hoping to actually make a combination of both. Part of the – so for sure it'll have application at the recurrence of mm-hmm. cancer. And that's in particular the whole thrust of this research program is to look at how the cancer recurs and then to target that mechanisms by how it was able to recur. But part of what we're hoping is once we identify this portfolio of resistance mechanisms, our initial treatments can explore and actually target those resistance pathways at the same time that we target the original targeted pathways that we are examining.
Is it possible that that kind of approach might preclude the tumor from coming back?
That certainly is the great promissory note, is that if we come up with more effective combinatorial therapy, recognizing the dynamic nature of the tumor and trying to anticipate. I like to use this sort of metaphor here and I realize sports metaphors are overused, but the great Gretzky always said that his success as a hockey player was not to skate to where the puck is, but where the puck is going to be.
Going to be, yeah.
So our idea would be is if we can see where the tumor is going to go, we not only treat what we see today, we not only go to where the puck is, but we actually start treating where the tumor might go.
Huh. How personalized does this need to be? I mean, for example, if you have two patients with the same kind of cancer and tumors with similar characteristics who are getting similar treatments, might this work for both of them, or is it so unique to each individual patient that everybody who has this would need their own specific sort of mechanism for getting it?
Well, what we're hoping is that we will identify some commonalities, some common pathways or processes that the cancer uses. But almost assuredly, we're going to have precision personalized medicine. So this is going to require us to be looking at each individual's tumor to see what their unique characteristics are, because I don't think in advance we'll be able to identify what might be an efficacious treatment for someone.
Well, it sounds like going back to your sports metaphor, it sounds like the real challenge is figuring out where the puck is going and mm-hmm. trying to get there first.
Indeed. And And I think that's what's new in this approach of this broader program, and credit to the program's organizers to recognize that there is – we're now at an inflection point, this unique opportunity where we actually have the technology, the modeling approaches. We use artificial intelligence in order to interpret through these huge volumes of data to try to find out where the puck is going. And we're hoping that, you know, with this new approaches, we're going to actually save lives. We really will be able to make a difference both in preventing the recurrence and when recurrence occurs, having a much more efficacious outcome.
And is the expectation that that next iteration of treatment would look kind of like what the treatments we imagine today, just like maybe a different recipe for chemotherapy or a different dose of radiation, or is there some other kind of treatment that might be on the offing?
So actually a combination of both. Part of what we're hoping to be able to do is more effectively target the existing therapies. So in other words, rather than just having to shoot into the dark and say, well, this could work in this patient,
yeah,
we'll say, well, based on their mechanisms here, this should work in this patient. So so rather than could, should. So we're hoping to more, you know, be effective at targeting the existing therapies. But what we really think is one of the sort of mind expanding opportunity here is as we identify these mechanisms of resistance, it may open up all sorts of new doors for new therapies that don't exist today. We say, oh, well, the reason these folks aren't responding is because of this. If we had a therapy that could target that, then we may be able to have more progress. So I think it'll be a combination of more effective delivery of existing approved therapies, but actually giving us clues as to what could be the next set of therapies.
Hmm. And are you imagining that that could include different modes of treatment? Like it could be in pill form or an injection or something, as opposed to, you know, having the way that cancer patients get their treatment now?
Oh, yeah. I think the sky is the limit. I think we've only just begun to scratch the surface of what might be the potential mechanisms that we could be utilizing.
All right. Well, Ken, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ken Buto is a professor at ASU. He's with the Center for Evolution and Medicine in the School of Complex Adaptive Systems and in the School of Life Sciences.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. President Trump begins a visit to the UK tomorrow for a look at what he can expect by way of welcome when he gets there, as well as some other top stories from around the globe. I am joined now by the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, there's a lot of pomp and circumstance planned for the president's arrival, correct?
Yes. So the President and First Lady will arrive in the UK scheduled for Tuesday evening, tomorrow evening local time. And what you really are going to see is a lot of pomp and pageantry, because if you look at Wednesday, well, they're at Windsor Castle. There'll be a carriage procession through the Windsor estate towards the castle, which means that President Trump won't be in touch with the British public. That carriage procession is across the Windsor estate and therefore protected, if you like, from protesters or anyone else who would want to get anywhere near him. Mm. Then there is lunch in the state dining room there with members of the royal family. Then a visit to St. George's Chapel in Windsor for a private wreath laying at the tomb of Queen Elizabeth II, followed by a state banquet at Windsor Castle. So, my goodness me, that's going to be full-on royalty all day on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, President Trump and the First Lady bid farewell to the royal family, and they travel to Chequers, which is the 16th century manor house, the kind of grace and favour mansion that the British Prime Minister, all British Prime Ministers get. And Sir Keir Starmer, our current Prime Minister, will host President Trump there. Just looking at it from the British point of view, well, as you know, President Trump is so central to so much of the global agenda at the moment. And when you look at it from Britain's prime minister's point of view, well, he's got to think about tariffs. Britain has actually done quite well on the tariff question, which, of course, has affected so many countries around the world adversely. And, of course, he will really want America's help in sorting out the situation in Ukraine, which all European countries, whether they're in the EU or not, regard as a European security issue. I should just say briefly, there will also be, I'm sure, questions to President Trump about his association with Jeffrey Epstein. And the reason for that is because last week the British sacked their ambassador in Washington, Peter Mandelson, for his connections with Jeffrey Epstein. One other really quick thing, and that is that in the last hour or two, Elon Musk has been condemned, if you like, by the British government because he took part in a video link with a far-right rally in London on Saturday in which he called for essentially the UK government to be replaced. And he tried to sort of rouse, if you like, the people at that rally. And that's upset the government here. And they've now criticized him for that. So, my goodness, there's going to be a lot to talk about.
Yes.
With the President Trump visit.
Yes, a lot of stories that I think President Trump perhaps thought were behind him that may follow him over there. Let's pivot now, Rob. Military exercises in Europe and in Asia will be in the headlines this coming week. Why is that?
Yes, I've actually just walked past the television showing Global News, and what it shows is Russian and Belarusian military exercises going on right now. And in fact, they started on Friday. They last for 5 days, and we're into the fourth day of those. The reason why they're significant is because Russia and Belarus are neighbors, and the last time they held such big military drills was in 2022, and Russian forces did not at that point return to Russia. Instead, they went into Ukraine. So that was a pivotal and historic moment, and of course Europe is watching these drills for very good reason, so much so indeed that Poland, which is on the eastern flank of NATO, a NATO member, closed its border with Belarus on Thursday evening of last week. And that's partly because just earlier than that, 19 Russian drones crossed into Polish airspace. The Poles said this was no accident. The Russians were trying to test NATO, trying to test what kind of response they might expect from the Western Defense Alliance, and that this was all actually pre-planned. And in fact, a day or two later, a Russian drone crossed into Romania, which is another of the 32 members of the NATO alliance. So clearly something is going on here. So we've got those going on, but also we have big military drills going on in Asia as well between the US, Japan and South Korea. And they have been criticized by North Korea, which describes them as provocative, which it usually does. But ironically, part of the reason for those drills is because of the perceived threat of North Korea itself. But anyway, we'll see that very much in the news and in the headlines this week as well.
Well, finally, Rob, a slightly different story coming out of Russia. This coming week, we're going to see headlines about a song contest in Moscow. It's called Intervision.
Yeah, so Russian officials announced the details of this revival of a song contest in Moscow. It was once billed as the Eastern Bloc's answer to Eurovision. Some of your listeners may know Eurovision is a huge bonanza that brings European countries and others together for a big song contest every year. Russia is currently excluded from that contest because of its war in Ukraine. So it's effectively saying, look, if you're not going to invite us to your song contest, we'll have our own. Interestingly, it's got quite a history. It was launched under the former Soviet leader Leonid Brezhnev. Not only is it sort of, you know, the Russian song contest to rival the Eurovision song contest, it's also to underline the ideological difference between the two. So Eurovision is well known for being kind of glitzy, very diverse, very encouraging of anyone from a non-traditional background, shall we say, whereas the Russian one is openly touting traditional values, family values. Many of the performers will be from former Soviet states, but also other countries that lean towards Russia, if you like, from around the world. So it'll be an interesting spectacle one way or another.
Yes, lots of spectacle on the agenda this week. Well, that is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones keeping us in the loop as always. Rob, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. And now, Sam, let's take a moment for one of my very favorite things, Jane Austen.
Here we go.
Might I ask why with so little endeavour at civility I'm less repulsed?
And I might as well inquire why, with so evident a design of insulting me, you chose to tell me that you like me against your better judgment.
No, believe me,
If I was uncivil, then that is some excuse, but I have other reasons. You know I have.
What reasons?
Do you think that anything might tempt me to accept a man who has ruined, perhaps forever, the happiness of a most beloved sister?
Ah, so good. That was, of course, one of the most famous scenes from Joe Wright's 2005 version of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, starring Keira Knightley.
Such great performances in that movie. And the film has become kind of a classic. In fact, it celebrated its 20th anniversary this spring. The internet was full of Mr. Darcy memes, and the movie was re-released to theaters packed with Austenites, often dressed in Regency-era attire.
It is a testament to the lasting impact of the author herself, who still captivates readers worldwide nearly 250 years after her time. And while you might have a prim and proper vision of Jane Austen in your mind, our next guest is here to tell you that was far from the truth. In her new book, Wild for Austen, Austen scholar and ASU English professor Devaney Loser argues Austen had much more than a small life in the English countryside and was much more than a quiet spinster who never married and instead wrote about the love stories she never lived out. From her association with abolitionists to her penchant for making money, Loser paints a picture of a subversive, rebellious Austen. I spoke with her more about it and why she hinges the book on the word wild.
I was looking at this word in her fiction, and it turns out that it's kind of a linchpin word, and it's often used to describe women and their behavior and their personal style positively. And I think this is really important to understand. So in the book, I was looking at not only her writings and reassessing those for, I think, their legitimate wildness, is how I'd put it, but also then looking at her life and the people surrounding her, and that they weren't as boring and, you know, small and uninteresting as we've been told. And then finally at her legacy.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start with a little bit about her own life. She was connected to the women's suffrage movement, to the abolitionist movement.
Not directly connected. I think connected through the people that she knew and the people that she was socially a part of groups with. So in her lifetime, we have the sense that she was completely unknown. And this is not true. By the 18-teens, when her books start to be published, she starts to get a reputation, even though her name's not on the page of her novels, not on the pages of her novels.
Right.
Her reputation as their author starts to fly around so that the Prince Regent himself knows that Jane Austen is the author of Pride and Prejudice in these books and invites her to, or his royal librarian invites her to come see the library. We know that she did this tour of the library. The Prince Regent was a big gossip. I don't think there's any reason to believe that this was, this was a secret. So by the 18-teens, she is hanging out with some pretty incredible people, mostly through her brother Henry. One of them, it turns out, was an international spy who was later assassinated.
What?
And, you know, I think this is not the kind of person we imagine Jane Austen sitting in a drawing room with, but it absolutely was. And although some biographies give this a sentence or two, I wanted to see what happens when we give this an entire chapter, several thousand words, to try to say, what would this have meant that Austen knew this international spy and his opera diva wife?
Right.
What does it mean that Jane Austen was hanging out with groups of radicals and radical politicians and the women in their lives?
That's so interesting, right? So what's your conclusion there? Like, what does it mean that she was associated with some of these people who were, you know, so radical at the time?
Well, I think it's really interesting that she doesn't choose to write about them directly.
Yeah.
I think that says something, and I'm not sure, that we can say exactly what it says. But it says that this was a choice she made. And, not like, oh, poor Jane Austen, she never married. And, she could only imagine romance and she had to write about these small villages because she didn't know anything else. This was a deliberate choice that she made and an artistic choice. And I think that's important. Hmm. It's not born out of limitation. It's born out of the sense, perhaps, of the audience she was trying to reach, the genre she was contributing to, and what she wanted to make her art.
The word savvy comes to mind in a way to me that, like, we would never have assumed of Austen.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a line in her letters where she says, "I love pewter." And what she means is, "I love money." she's glad she's making money from her writing. This was important to her as a novelist, as a woman who was dependent on the men in her family without this money. I think these are all things that show us that she was an ambitious and, I think a genius novelist. These were not things that she didn't understand about herself. Mm-hmm. And they are things that we should credit her positively for, a kind of wildness that I think she was willing to go outside of convention for what was ideal feminine behavior to create this life.
Devaney, do you think of this as like a feminist interpretation of Austen in a way? Because it seems to me that like history may have underestimated her or assumed in some way that her writings, her success, what she wrote about, it was sort of almost an accident.
Yeah, I absolutely see this as feminist or proto-feminist. The word feminist doesn't really enter the language in the term we understand it, in the form we understand it until later in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. But critics since the 1930s have been associating Jane Austen's fiction with feminism, but it still hasn't stuck with the public.
Okay, so I have to ask you about kind of your process, right? Because, I mean, you're an Austen scholar, this is what you do, but Jane Austen is so popular, like so well studied. It seems like such well-tread territory. How do you do this? How do you discover new things about her and still surprise us today?
It is a process. It's a really exciting research process. And I'm grateful to Arizona State University for making it possible for me to travel to some of the world's best archives, as well as to have access to subscription databases that allow me to mess around online and find things that haven't been noticed before in 19th century newspapers.
Tell us about that. Where did you go for this?
Yeah, so there are many digitized newspapers, and I just started very deliberately looking for references to her brothers. And one after another, I found that first her brother Henry, then her brother Charles, and then her brother Francis had all joined publicly the abolitionist movement as activists in the 1820s, in the near years after her death. And this is something that previous critics and scholars hadn't noticed. Huh. And so to be able to prove that her family had these connections, or at least half of her siblings had these connections, and then to speculate, what does that mean for what we know about what Austen was doing 10 or so years before? And I think it shows us that there was a movement toward a kind of abolitionist mindset among her siblings.
Wow.
Now, it is true that some of her family members, even some close family members, were making their fortunes off of the labor of enslaved people. Mm-hmm. So this is a movement, I think, in her family away from a tacit acceptance of that, although they never benefited directly economically themselves. They, like many, benefited indirectly toward her siblings moving into a real anti-slavery, pro-abolition mindset and public movement. Because we've been told that Jane Austen's family was apolitical and conservative, I think a lot of people weren't looking for this.
Yeah.
But I did look for the needle in the haystack and found it three times. So how do you like that?
How do you like that? Okay, so I have to ask you lastly, Devaney, about maybe the greatest debate about Jane Austen, although I know there are very many, which is the best version of her classic Pride and Prejudice when it comes to movies. Like the Keira Knightley version just had its 20th anniversary. It was re-released in theaters. A big hit once again. Lots of sort of millennials my age very excited to see this getting so much attention again because we loved it so much. But of course, there are camps in this realm in terms of which is the best movie version. What's your opinion? How do you weigh in here?
So, I'm 58 years old. Colin Firth is my Darcy and probably always will be. But my students tell me that that is not the case. That's their mother's Darcy, or, pretty soon it'll be their grandmother's Darcy. I get why this happens, that maybe the Darcy we first saw when we were young women, when we came of age, is one that imprints itself on us. But I have to say, I happened to be in California during that 2005 Joe Wright Pride Prejudice re-release, and there was a ball, and I got to go
Oh,
to the ball. I
that
don't know
was
if you
so
saw
great.
that, Lauren. It was amazing, and I loved seeing the young. It was mostly a much younger audience, and how excited they were. So
Well,
I can make room for all of the Darcys.
all of the Darcys are welcome. All right. Devonnie Loser, Regents Professor of English at ASU. The new book is Wild for Austin, a rebellious, subversive, and untamed Jane. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lauren.
All right, that'll do it for this edition of the show. We will, of course, be back with you again tomorrow morning with much more. And we want to say a very special thank you to everyone who came out last night and packed Crescent Ballroom in downtown Phoenix to watch us do the show live on stage. It was a good time.
It was a very good time. I don't know if any of us expected it to end with much of the staff becoming backup dancers for Mega Ran.
A moment I will never live down.
That's live radio, I suppose.
All right. Don't forget, you can always follow us on Instagram. Sign up for our newsletter at theshow.kjzz.org. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I am Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.